This week on COVID, Race, and Democracy.
Compañeros, we are here today to tell Governor Gavin Newsom to sign that bill! Sign that bill!
Sign that bill! Sign
that bill! Thousands march for farm worker rights in Sacramento and urge Governor Newsom to sign Assembly Bill 2183 to benefit farm workers' unionization efforts.
We are now reifying for presidential posthumous pardon for my dad, but of course it has to say that he was innocent and the charges were not substantiated.
Dr. Julius Garvey, son of Marcus Garvey, has been working since the 80s to clear his father's name.
The unions and communities, we know exactly what our problem is. Our problem is capitalism.
And community activists join a general strike in South Africa. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Akua Holt. On Friday, thousands of farm workers and their supporters rallied in Sacramento for a bill to benefit farm workers. The rally came after a march of 338 miles from Central Valley to Sacramento. They were demanding that Governor Newsom support Assembly Bill 2183 that would allow farm workers to vote for a union by mail ballot and allow unions to get the names and addresses of all farm workers. Miguel Molina and Frank Sterling attended the march and rally and recorded for KPFA's Flashpoints.
In the United Farm Workers' last leg of the pilgrimage, as we're approaching the Capitol, we're getting ready, energized, to demand that the governor sign this bill. There's rumors already that he's not going to sign. If that is true, then shame on him, and no voto for us, no voto for you. And as we're walking, there, it seems like at this point there's several thousand people behind us, and it's only growing larger. People are coming off the streets and joining the pilgrimage, joining the walk to the Capitol steps, and the beautiful weather, beautiful sunshine. It's not as torturous as it has been. And the energy here is unbelievable.
Take it down, Miguel.
As I've heard people say all morning, this is the rebirth of La Causa. This is the re-emergence of El Movimiento. And it really is. The majority of people here, I would say, are youth, probably under 40, between high school age and 40. And they're energized. The energy here is unbelievable. All the leaders, Dolores Huerta, Paul Chavez, have gathered today, Arturo Rodriguez, to honor the day here. And the energy, again, is unreal. The love from the community and the people. And one of the most noticeable things that I saw is the diversity of this group. It's just not a farm worker issue. There are people here who appreciate the bounty of food, the nourishment that's produced by farm workers, and it's really evident today. We continue on to the Capitolio. Si se puede.
Hi, this is Feeble in Franklin. We're here at the pre-kickoff gathering, and I'm here with Heriberto. And you're the march director. It's been 24 days. You're just a few blocks away. How are you feeling before we actually head off to the Capitol today?
You know, I'm very emotional. I'm very honored to be able to be in a position where I'm helping create history for the farm worker movement. You know, it's been a tough 24 days. A lot of people have suffered tremendously on this pilgrimage from Delano to Sacramento, 335 miles. And it's just been an incredible journey, both physical, but also emotional. It's been an opportunity for the farm workers to also create a lot of supporters, engage a lot of supporters along the way. It's just been an incredible 24 days. And we're culminating our pilgrimage here in Sacramento at Southside Park with the final mile to the Capitol. It's just an opportunity for us to really show the governor what we do and why farm workers are so important to this country. And we're coming together with not just farm workers from, but Latinos and people of faiths of so many other different, you know, religions. And so anyway, I'm just really emotional right now as we're waiting for folks to arrive.
And how'd you feel yesterday? Were you part of the delegation that went over and saw the assembly and all that? How did that feel to get that recognition for the people that actually been, you know, putting their flesh on the line and their sweat and tears?
You know, we have a quite tremendous leadership in the assembly and in the Senate. Our Senator Maria Elena Durazo, Speaker Pro Tem Atkins, welcomed farm workers in the Senate chambers and welcomed them and really honored their sacrifice as they arrived to Sacramento. And so that's something we wouldn't have seen 10 years ago. Now we have a really strong a group of legislators in Sacramento that are supporting this bill and supporting farm workers' rights. And so we're very encouraged to see that.
And I guess lastly, before I let you go, I know you're really busy. How do you feel about the governor? I know it's no one really knows, but you know, I know our hopes are all high because after all this, what we've done, but how are you personally feeling? And
yeah. Well, you know, the governor needs to understand that farm workers are here because they're here to show him that their humanity matters. I'm hopeful that someday we'll win this piece of legislation for farm workers, that we will win this right for farm workers to be able to vote for a union, change their working conditions without any sort of retaliation whatsoever, to be able to vote for their union from the comfort and safety of wherever they want to vote from. So I'm hopeful. I'm filled with a lot of hope. Seeing a lot of people here fills me with a lot of hope as well. And it's just something that, you know, we got to keep fighting for every single day.
And let me hear your beautiful name pronounced how it should be before I let you go.
My name is Heriberto Fernandez, the March Director for the United Farm Workers.
Well, thank you again. You did such a great job. I'm very proud of you, and I look forward to today.
Likewise, brother. Thank you so much for joining us.
All right.
Si se puede! 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 Si se puede!
Compañeros, compañeras, un aplauso to the peregrinos who made today their final mile, 335 miles from the Laredo to Sacramento. Un aplauso para los peregrinos. ¡Campesinos! ¡Viva! ¡Que viva Dolores Huerta!
¡Viva!
¡Que viva César Chávez!
¡Viva!
¡Que viva Teresa Romero!
¡Viva!
Brothers and sisters, our peregrinos marched 335 miles from Delano to Sacramento. They may have blisters on their feet. Their feet have become cuts and bruised and swollen, but their spirits remain strong and their energy remains high. And they know at the end of the day that their si se puede attitude will carry them through the day. Compañeros, we are here today to tell Governor Gavin Newsom to sign that bill. All together, sign that bill.
Sign that bill. Sign that bill. Sign that bill! Sign that bill! Sign that bill! Sign that bill! Sign that bill!
Sign that bill!
That was the march and rally for California Assembly Bill 2183 that would allow for mail ballots in elections and allow the unions to get the addresses of workers. We thank journalists Miguel Molina and Frank Sterling reporting for KPFA's Flashpoints.
No nos moverán.
Firmes estaremos.
No nos moverán. Nuestro ideal es faro de victoria. No nos moverán.
Peleamos por justicia.
No nos moverán.
Suave Rhyme by Los Lobos and Friends. This is Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. On Wednesday, October 24th, thousands of workers and community members throughout South Africa went on a day of strike action and protest. Aisha Raja, who is chairperson of the Sofa Sanke Community Civic Organization, spoke with Pacifica about the conditions that led to the walkout in South Africa.
Aisha Raja, I'm the chairperson of the Sofa Sanke Civic Association. Civic, who are mostly women-headed households, it's a nightmare. During COVID, many of our members lost their jobs. And it was an uphill battle for these working class people who had, up till COVID, managed to somehow keep roof over their heads and food on the table. And now it's become almost an impossibility. There are no safety nets. There are no government programs that help people who lost their jobs during the pandemic. You know, when the pandemic started, we were told we have this huge budget to help the community and especially the poor. But of course, we know what happened to that. And so it's an everyday struggle for people just to live with a little bit of dignity. Just yesterday, one of the MECs of Health, actually a patient was about to be operated on, had to hear from her how that poor person is now taking resources from South African communities, which is all rubbish. It's absolute rubbish. And that is why it's so important for communities on the ground to be involved. Because when you actually ask people in communities, please explain to me, how have these poor immigrants taken your jobs? They'd be very hard pressed to actually explain to you how that works. So yes, this is just the beginning. You know, we really have to go back to the way we organized pre-1994. In fact, I think we have to be much more resolute now. The working class summit was really a summit that SAFTU, the other union, called. We want working class unity, but we are very well aware of the differences. In fact, yesterday on the march, as we were marching, I was very much with the COSATU comrades, but it gave us the opportunity and I expressed my displeasure. And I said, you are actually, by being married to government, you are selling us down the river. So this opens up avenues for us to talk. And this is the rank and file of the union movement. And I think it's very, very important for us not to be sectarian and for us to continue to speak with the rank and file. Because the rank and file of the unions and communities, we know exactly what our problem is. Our problem is capitalism and middle class people too, because they are really feeling the pinch in terms of interest rates. Those who own their homes, they're losing their homes. I live above the sheriff of the court here, and the auctions are fast and furious. You know, people are barely surviving. So, yeah. Even the middle class is shrinking. And they know they're going to have to throw their lot in with us, with the working class, because they're on their way to oblivion, actually. There will only be the very rich.
That was Aisha Raja, chair of the Sofa Sanke Community Civic Organization in Johannesburg, South Africa. John Klimmer, Touch. This is Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. The United Automobile Workers recently wrapped up their constitutional convention, which saw major changes from previous conventions from both outside and inside the union. Externally, as part of an ongoing corruption scandal, a federally imposed monitor is overseeing the finances and operations of the International Union from early 2021 until 2027. Internally, as a result of membership pressure and the emergence of a significant reform caucus, UAWD. Rank and file membership of UAW, for the first time in their union's history, will directly elect the leadership of the union as embodied in its International Executive Board, IEB. These changes, while promising a more democratic structure in the union, are not occurring evenly nor without resistance from the ruling administration caucus. Still entrenched in certain locals, mail balloting is scheduled for late October to November 28. WPFW's Thomas O'Rourke spoke to UAW Local 1264 President LaShawn English, who is running for UAW Regional Director 1 in Detroit, and UAW Local 909's retired president, Frank Hammer, about union corruption, electoral intimidation, and manipulation, as well as some of the challenges facing new union officers, board members, and rank-and-file workers.
This is Thomas O'Rourke of Pacifica Radio. I'm here on the phone interviewing Frank Hammer and LaShawn English, both from Detroit, both members of the United Auto Workers, currently or retired.
I'm a retired UAW GM worker from the former GM powertrain plant in Warren, Michigan. I was an activist and an elected officer of my local from 1975 to 1995, during which time I served in the capacity of local union president and also bargaining chairman.
I am LaShawn English. I'm presently the president of Local 1264. It's Stellantis/Chrysler facility. Been the president for 3 terms. Also, I am running for international position as the regional director for Region 1.
In my region, my plant, Local 909, is part of Region 1, and my retirees, who can no longer meet at the UAW Hall because it's been sold, because our plant is, our retirees meeting was held at the Region 1 headquarters. In advance of the meeting, per the rules, I and another brother were distributing campaign literature for LaShawn English and the other candidates of the Members United. And all went fine. When I stepped in the door and became part of the meeting, the first thing that occurred was that the Region 1 CAP director or CAP coordinator announced that it was illegal to be distributing any kinds of campaign material for the elections and for the election of the regional director per the federal monitor, which I knew was completely wrong. And so the coordinator, the CAP coordinator, after he concluded telling approximately 100 retirees that it was illegal for them to have these leaflets in their possession, left the podium and went to the various tables where the retirees were sitting and snatched back the leaflets that we had been passing out in advance of the meeting. So then the regional director spoke. The regional director made no comment in regards to what the CAP coordinator, who works for him, did, and went on with his various remarks. And at the conclusion of his remarks, I got his attention and addressed him and told him that what had just gone down was completely illegal, and read him the relevant rule that, according to the monitor's rules, we're allowed to campaign before, during, and after the meeting as long as we did not do it inside the meeting, which, of course, is what I was doing. He very sheepishly acknowledged what I said and said, oh, he would talk to the CAP coordinator. I, in the meantime, informed the retirees that I would be back out in the parking lot, which is where I was originally distributing the leaflets, and I'd be glad to give leaflets to those retirees who had it snatched away from them. Some came out, said, oh, no, I didn't let go of mine, and some came out and said, yeah, I want one. The retirees were in full support of my comments to the regional director, and this is a flagrant violation, and, you know, having been someone who was in an official capacity in my local union for X number of years, I also worked on staff at the end of my UAW career, I know that the administration caucus, that's the caucus that's in power, and this conduct is very reminiscent of conduct that I encountered in 1983 when I went to my first convention. And it's like in their DNA, you know, it's this is the way they play and this is the way they deal. And what I think that's lost on the administration caucus is that there's currently federal oversight over their conduct. And we hope that the federal monitor will take action and, you know, forbid this kind of activity and, you know, and prevent this from going on, because these elections are going to be really quick. Before we know it, ballots will be issued in October and people and members and retirees will be voting. So this is something that's got to be taken up and addressed immediately.
You've alluded to the rules of the election. The monitor published a list of rules that where they said this is acceptable, this is not. I assume every candidate got a copy of the rules. How is it these people are asserting legitimacy to do these actions when anyone can look at the rules and know that's wrong?
In regards to the incident that I was describing, you know, I think that retirees, especially in a retiree chapter that had not been meeting for 3 years because of COVID, you know, I think that they were taken advantage of by the director and the CAP coordinator, because they presumed that the retirees were ignorant, didn't know what the rules, didn't know what was going on, and that they could get over on them quite easily. So I think that's very particular to the fact that this was a retiree chapter.
I want to say 90% of the membership is probably ignorant to the rules, because if you're not running, you really didn't see the rules. The rules, they're on the website. They're on a UAW website. So it wasn't mailed to everybody. You got to go searching for the rules. There are people who still don't even know that there is an election. I'm encountering that. So, and then in the rules, it does state that those candidates are responsible for knowing the rules and breaking the rules. There is a process. And that process is that you can call the hotline or you can send an email, and they'll get back with you to ask you to put official complaint in. Now, for the report, I don't know if they're going to put a report about all the complaints, but they will get back with you, and sometimes it's not timely, sometimes it is. I did just have a member who have, you know, normally some of the members that say to the candidates, like, I don't think that's right. Well, what I just saw, that doesn't seem right. And, you know, people know certain things about elections. Like, I get phone calls like, why are you not allowed to come to a meeting? I explain that to them. They're like, well, that ain't right. I said, well, you need to call, contact the monitor, the rules. And there are people who are calling, but it's just not enough. I mean, it may or may not. But it's one of those things that I see with the administrative caucus. I'm trying to stay within the rules. I'm following the rules because I know they'll call on me because, you know, they're making sure their people know the rules. But they're more like catching what you can, and if you catch me, oh, well, I'm sorry, little mistake. As like Frank says, I watched physically at a picnic. We came in to register for the picnic, to come to a picnic. There was nothing on the registration table. So after we're there, we see his staff come in. He leaves very quickly, but I noticed her. And the next minute we get ready to leave, his stuff is on the table. And they know that's not wrong. They had a conversation with a member who happens to know the rules, but tried to rectify the rules, and they wanted me to violate the rules. I said, well, you have a right to put it on the table just like he did. I said, no. You ain't supposed to do that. This is during your picnic, which is considered a union meeting, is a union activity, so the rules state how we can and cannot. But the problem is that you want me to put my stuff on there because this member just told you guys she was contacting the monitor. So you're arrest you to rectify you knowing that you and James, you were James clearly there at the picnic. He seen it. He was there. They were taking pictures with his stuff at the registration table. So it's not like you don't know this. So again, I guess to me, I think until somebody steps up to them, they were like, oh, I didn't know. I didn't know the rules. But the guy was like, I'm letting the monitor know. He's here and it's our job. If somebody on my camp, and it's in the rules, is even if someone on my team or somebody that's supporting me, you know, they have to follow the rules. And if they don't, I'm held accountable for their actions. It's in the rules.
Thank you for that, President English. Assuming you're elected to the International Executive Board, this issue of corruption in the United Auto Workers seems to be relatively new from my understanding. It's not historically been a major problem. But as a result of this corruption, there is a federal monitor currently overseeing the union for a period of years. How would you handle, and how are you telling your members in your campaign, how would you handle corruption? Do you see the federal monitor as being a positive thing, or is it something you and other members want to, you know, get out from under as quickly as possible and bring back the issue of, you know, corruption, that it be taken care of in-house, so to speak?
Great question. Me, myself, personally, having the monitor there and the cost that it costs to the membership, that hurts us during bargaining. And so we have to get rid of it. I mean, it's great for now, and I'm hoping, well, we still got some open investigation. Just as of March, they sent out a report. So that's really disturbing to me right there. Just hopefully when I get elected, when I'm elected, so I can get on top of that. Because, again, the monitor has said there's some 19 open cases still open as of now, you know. So that's kind of disturbing. It's like we need them. And we do need new people to get rid of the corruption and change some of the behavior. But having them there, it may bring some of the trust back to the membership. But once they're removed, we got to make big plans in place to bring that trust back into the membership where they don't want us to have a federal monitor or anybody. Because at the end of the day, the union's job is to protect its members. There's no way that we should have someone to protect our members, to protect the people who are supposed to protect the members. This is crazy.
I just want to add, in regards to the damage that was done to the UAW, in regards to the administration caucus corruption, the worst part of it is envisioning a billboard in Chattanooga, Tennessee,
yes,
talking about, do you want to bring that corruption here? And the fact that these are coming from the Center for Union Facts or the National Right to Work Committee, the fact that the UAW leadership gave them material facts to use against the UAW is something that you can make restitution with stolen money, but how do you make restitution with the UAW's name? And I think that without having new leadership leading the UAW, in the likes of LaShawn English and the other candidate, I don't think that we're going to have a possibility of turning the corner on organizing the non-union transplant workers today. And they're benefiting by the UAW's work in the organized plants, but they're not being organized, and we have to turn that corner. Critically important.
That was UAW 909 retiree Frank Hammer and UAW Director 1 candidate LaShawn English speaking to Thomas O'Rourke from WPFW about efforts to promote union democracy and protect the livelihoods of tens of thousands of auto workers.
It seemed to be the right time, the right place, a love of country to the fore. Smiles on eager faces, the nation's heartbeat heard once more. Those in power knew just what they wanted. Divide and rule was their cry. When the votes were cast and counted, the hopes of thousands
Stand Together by COB. This is Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. The increasing behavioral health problems are affecting millions, including healthcare workers. Since August 15, 2000, National Union of Healthcare Workers Therapists at the Kaiser HMO in Northern California and Hawaii have been on strike for their patients and their own healthcare. Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer has been covering their actions and their rally at Kaiser headquarters on January 19th. Now to their voices.
With Kaiser, 12 years. And clinicians joined the union. It was the first time our union had experience with behavioral health care, lots of experience on the medical side. And we quickly learned the huge problems about access to care that existed within Kaiser. And we did a white paper. We interviewed hundreds of clinicians and produced a white paper called Care Delayed, Care Denied. Some of you remember that and contribute to that, right? And we, in a very constructive way, went to the president of Kaiser at that time and said, we want to work with you to fix the problems. We want to collaborate with you, much like we did on the medical side, to make Kaiser the best place to receive behavioral health care and the best place to give mental health care. That offer was rejected. And we began to expose the problems with Kaiser and release that paper to the press, and Kaiser's reaction was, you know what, we're never going to give NUHW a contract because you went public, because you're standing up to us. That really happened. So it took 5 years of strikes and actions to finally win the first time contract with Kaiser.
My name is Laura Bramble, and I'm a Kaiser patient. I had an appointment this past Monday that was simply canceled, and there was no offer of other treatment options that was given to me. I mean, I'm dealing with anxiety and depression, and so this puts my anxiety kind of through the roof. You know, okay, my appointment is canceled, my therapist is on strike, when am I going to see her again? And, you know, I'm flying without a net right now. It's scary. I'm actually covered through Medicare and Medi-Cal, so I'm not paying my own premiums, but I mean, somebody's paying for me to get health care that I'm not getting. So.
The taxpayer is paying for you to get premiums.
Yeah, so.
Well, isn't that fraud? Because Kaiser says that they're supposed to provide treatment. They're getting paid to provide treatment, but they're not doing that?
It's fraud. It's a lie. It's BS. It's, you know, it's not true. You know, I mean, they have a statement out that says that, oh, we're providing care for patients while this work stoppage is going on. And I don't know how they think that's happening. If there are clinicians who, for whatever reason, cannot join their colleagues out here, you know, it means the people that are out here aren't getting paid. So if this bozo in the C-suite up there thinks that clinicians who are in the office can absorb the overflow when their caseloads are already bulging, he really doesn't get what's going on in mental health.
I am Anessa Larson. I'm a psychologist at the Department of Psychiatry in Vallejo.
Why are there suicides at Kaiser?
One of the biggest problems that we have is access to care. So while there's so many patients that need care and need the support that are in crisis, they're languishing out in just waiting for a just even so many of my colleagues have felt that they can no longer provide services that are within best practices even at Kaiser, so they're leaving. So the therapists that are left are holding way more patients than any, you know, clinician can. And so the people are absolutely, you know, at this point, not able to see patients at even longer times. So it's really, 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 you know, challenging. The pandemic made, you know, an already broken system even worse. And then here we are today. There's been no changes. We're out of contract. Kaiser won't come to the middle. They won't come to understand what it means to be a mental health clinician today in this huge Kaiser system. I want Kaiser to be able to provide the best care possible. I think it's possible. I think they can do it. They just really have to listen to the boots on the ground, the therapists who really know what it's like and what is needed for their patients. They're not listening to it. They're not listening. I work hours over each day just to make sure that the patients that I do have are seen or at least heard, or at least I can get an email back to them or a call back to them. I don't get paid for those hours. I don't get any kind of acknowledgement for that hours. And in fact, that is one of the main sticking points in terms of our contract, is how do we provide the care for the patients that we have? We have so many patients on our panels and no ability to close panels, no ability to actually kind of coordinate how we see patients in a way that they can be seen in a really timely manner. So what we're really looking for is more time to be able to see patients, touch patients, be able to get connected with them. The research really supports being able to have, you know, even a little bit of time with their clinicians to then be able to establish treatment of care and then know what needs to be done.
My name is Mari. My pronouns are they, them. I'm a proud first-generation child of immigrants. I'm bicultural, bilingual, queer, and non-binary. I'm one of few queer, trans clinicians of color across the Northern California region. I can count as on one finger. On Monday, July 25th, our clinic received its first threatening voicemail, calling any clinician involved in pediatric care malicious, ill-intentioned, predatory individuals mutilating children. As we received more of these voicemails, it became clear that this would not be the end. At this moment in time, there are over 25 anti-trans pieces of legislation circulating our country. At this moment in time, there are over 270 anti-LGBTQIA pieces of legislation circulating our country. As NUHW members, us gender therapists want you to know that we strike not only for patient care, but for our patients' right to exist, for our right to exist.
So give it up for Natalie Rogers. She works for the Santa Rosa Emergency Team.
I am a clinician of color in Santa Rosa. I am a survivor from my sister killed herself 1 month before my 16th birthday, and she died at Kaiser Vallejo. There we go. I am a mother of a currently transitioning, and I am the mother of a young woman who is finding herself, and I am okay with that. But I'm also a mother for 8 children, some of which need therapy that cannot get therapy because they are Kaiser members. They cannot get therapy in a timely manner. And some that have the means will go and pay for outside care. Everyone does not have the means to do that. So this becomes an equity issue, Kaiser!
Those were striking NUHW Kaiser therapists and behavioral healthcare workers speaking with Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer.
Rally round the red, gold, black and green.
That was a classic, Rally Round by Steel Pulse, Ode to Marcus Garvey. Black August salute to the Honorable Marcus Messiah Garvey. Here's Garland Nixon of Pacifica's WPFW's News Views, along with Dr. Julius Garvey, son of Marcus Messiah Garvey. Dr. Garvey is leading the effort, along with thousands of supporters, to clear his father's name. The Honorable Marcus Messiah Garvey was born on August 17, 1887, in Jamaica. He was a Pan-African activist, publisher, journalist, entrepreneur, and orator. Garvey was the founder and president general of the Universal Negro Improvement Association, the UNIA, and the African Communities League. He was a visionary and entrepreneur who believed Africans must be financially independent of European colonizers at home and abroad. He created several businesses in the U.S., including the Negro Factories Corporation and the Negro World Newspaper. In 1919, Garvey became president of the Black Star Line Shipping and Passenger Company. In 1923, Garvey was wrongfully convicted of mail fraud for selling the company's stock, and he was caged in United States Penitentiary, Atlanta, for approximately 2 years. Marcus Garvey's supporters have always maintained his innocence. Many believe Garvey was targeted by J. Edgar Hoover because of his political beliefs. Marcus Garvey made his transition on Juneteenth, 1940, in the UK. Here's Garland Nixon of Pacifica's WPFW News Views, along with Dr. Julius Garvey, son of Marcus Messiah Garvey.
If you've been listening to this show for many, many years, you know I've been fortunate enough in my life to have been able to associate with a number of great people. We used to have John Conyers on the show. Of course, you know, my mentor, the great Paul Robeson Jr., he used to come on back in the day. And now I am very, very fortunate again. I'm sure you have heard of one of the tallest trees in the forest, one of the greatest black men who've ever lived by the name of Marcus Garvey. And we are fortunate enough to have a friend of mine, brilliant man, a guy I have a tremendous a lot of respect for, and the son of Marcus Garvey, Dr. Julius Garvey. Dr. Garvey, welcome back to News Views.
Thank you so much for having me, Garland. It's indeed a pleasure to be back with you.
Oh, it's wonderful to talk to you. And here on the WPFW family and the News Views family, we feel like we're talking to royalty in the black community with all that your father has done. There's some really, really important stuff, and I want to make sure that our audience has the ability to participate and has the ability to help you and I work on a very, very important thing that you're working on. So let's talk about your project that you're working on to clear your father's name.
Yes, but it's something that we've been doing for a very long time, almost specifically since 1987, which was my father's centennial, when we appeared before the House Judiciary Committee. Interesting, you mentioned John Conyers' name. He was head of the House Judiciary Committee at that particular time. So myself, my brother, people such as John Henry Clark, Tony Martin, Robert Hill, and Judith Stein, and the Jamaican ambassador, Keith Johnson, we appeared before the House Judiciary Committee on giving evidence to show that the trial was a fraud and my father did not commit any crime. And we presented the evidence. Unfortunately, the Judiciary Committee did not see fit to grant my father an exoneration. But from then on, people such as Charles Rangel, who was chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, he would almost every year have a House resolution to clear my dad's name, and that went on for a long time. Eventually, in 2016, I made a petition now to Barack Obama, who was our first black president, and I felt that this was almost certain to go through, giving his background, and he should have the knowledge that he was standing on the shoulders of people who had gone before. That petition was ignored, if you will. It was prepared by our law firm there in D.C., Akin Gump, Shouse, Howard & Feld, which is a reputable law firm, which has done, you know, pro bono work for me, and examined the trial inside out and showed its inconsistency, the fact that it was a political trial, etc. So this was presented at that time. So we didn't do anything specific with President Trump, but now we have a Democrat in the White House, we have President Biden, and we are now reapplying for presidential posthumous pardon from my dad. But of course, it has to say that he was innocent and the charges were not substantiated. So that's where we are at the present time, beginning that particular drive.
I want to take the opportunity to give you my utmost respect for your father, the Right Honorable Marcus Garvey, who is the founder of the Universal Negro Improvement Association. If you could, the people maybe on here who maybe don't know much about your father or don't know about what happened, maybe we can give them a little bit of background about your father. Because, you know, we have some younger listeners and some people who may not know the history of the Honorable Marcus Garvey. So maybe if you could give them some history of what happened, because as I said, you know, my mentor was Paul Robeson Jr. We know what happened to his father. He stood up against the system. So many black leaders who stood up against the system attacked him. So a bit of history on your father, Marcus Garvey, if you please, sir.
Yeah, what you said is exactly right. My dad traveled all over the world and formed the Universal Negro Improvement Association and African Communities League in Kingston, Jamaica in 1914. And he formed it, as you can imagine, this was a period when slavery had just ended in 1838 and colonialism had started in 1884, 1885 with the Berlin Conference. Black people all over the world were, you know, being oppressed continually for the last 400 years. So this was a situation now where we were coming out of slavery and trying to reclaim everything that was taken away from us, meaning our history, our culture, our belief system, our religion, etc. Well, Marcus Garvey had a program for that, and a good part of it was based on Booker T. Washington's program at Tuskegee. He had read Booker T.'s Up from Slavery. So he corresponded with Booker T. and then came up in 1916 to the United States. Booker T. had died in 1915, but of course Tuskegee was there. So my dad came up because he wanted to model an institution in Jamaica after the Tuskegee Institute, because it was really building from the ground up in terms of the industrialization process that was taking place. In other words, training people in skills in terms of carpentry, electrician, you know, being contractors and builders and engineers, etc. This was how he felt that African people needed to rebuild their civilization and their identity. You know, part of it was historical, but the major part of it had to be economic, because that was the foundation. So the UNIA was basically an organization dedicated to the redemption, as he liked to call it, of African peoples everywhere, you know, in the diaspora and on the continent. He said Africa for the Africans, those at home and those abroad. You know, this was a message that African people were ready for. And he was the person to be able to deliver it, because he was a great orator. He was very charismatic. And his ideas were clear, and they were aimed at the masses. People wanted self-respect, people wanted dignity, they wanted jobs, and they wanted to be somebody. And this was the message. You are somebody, and you have a great history. You're the first people on the planet, and you're the first civilization, and we can rebuild even after the debacle of slavery. So people flocked to him, and by 1920, you know, he had about 2 million followers, and they had that magnificent parade in New York at Madison Square Gardens that started in 1920. And they had the Declaration of the Rights of the Negro Peoples of the World, which was essentially our Magna Carta. They were, like, you know, at that time, it brought about 2,500 delegates from all over the world to deliberate on the problems of the African people all over the world. And this is what they up with, you know, 53 different points stating how African people were being treated, what needed to be done to relieve that situation, and what we were going to do in terms of reconstructing our own civilization. So that was major. And he gave us a flag, as you know, the red, black, and green. That's where it was voted in at that particular time. The red for the blood of our ancestors shed through the slavery and the slave trade, you know, the black for who we are as a people, and the green for the wealth of our continent, both agricultural and mineral. So he constituted us as a nation in exile, and he was voted in as a provisional president of Africa. That's the basis of Marcus Garvey at that time. And in very short order, he had 1,000 branches all over the world, and 700 of which were in the United States. And he had more than 6 million followers over time. Now, people such as J. Edgar Hoover, who was a young lawyer who was coming up in the Justice Department, and he was looking to cut his teeth both on so-called communists and agitators. And he had an internal memo as early as 1919, an office memo that's saying there's a Negro agitator up in Harlem, and we've got to find some way to get him, you know, to shut him up. So Will Marcus Garvey was a target. And, of course, there was competition between his ideas of independence and self-sufficiency and other ideas of more of assimilation and integrating with the status quo as it was. And then there was also the far left, which was the communists and socialists, the African Blood Brothers, and so on and so forth. But, you know, his message really resonated with the people. There was antagonism there and the witch hunt, if you will, of the Federal Bureau of Investigation with J. Edgar Hoover at the head. And that's when you had the first black agents that were hired by the FBI to infiltrate my dad's organization. They ended up disrupting the organization and bringing information back to J. Edgar Hoover. That was the situation in the early 20s.
Once again, we're talking to Julius Garvey. He is the son of the Right Honorable Marcus Garvey, and we're talking about the Garvey Justice Project. Now, you can go to Twitter, at Justice and the number 4 Garvey. That's at Justice, the number 4 Garvey. Please follow that Twitter account. And also, if you go right below that, you can click on the White House website so that you can contact the White House. You can fill out a form. Don't you have a petition? That's it. The Clear Garvey Petition at change.org.
Many thanks to Garland Nixon of WPFW's News Views and Dr. Julius Garvey, son of Marcus Garvey. Dr. Garvey is a New York surgeon and is also a clinical associate professor of surgery at Albert Einstein College of Medicine. He has been on several educational and medical missions to Ghana, Senegal, Uganda, Mali, Sierra Leone, Jamaica, Haiti, South Sudan, and Ethiopia. Dr. Garvey lectures on the life and legacy of his father, the Honorable Marcus Mosiah Garvey. Find out more about the Marcus Garvey Petition on Twitter at Justice the number 4 Garvey. Justice for Garvey. And that concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all the Pacifica sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the executive producers of CRD, Aku Holt, Pauline Vasiliev, and Steve Zeltzer. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Please click the subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD and on Facebook at COVID Race and Democracy. I've been your host, Akua Holt. Thanks for listening.